So tonight I want to talk about the Sava Sava Sutta. Roughly translated as restraining and abandoning the taints. This is from Majjhima Nikaya number 2. And the first thing I want to do is say, what the heck is a taint? Right? 'Cause it's not a word we use a lot. And I actually looked up in the dictionary, as I want to do, and it says, a trace. Notice it's just a trace of something bad, offensive, or harmful. So it's just a trace. It isn't like a big pile, number one. And the Buddha talks about this in a variety of ways. This is from the Dhammapada, the first six verses of the Dhammapada. If you're not familiar with the Dhammapada, it's sort of a collection of sort of poetic sayings of the Buddha on a variety of topics. And this is a fairly new translation, so if you know the Dhammapada from an older translation, it might seem a bit different. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you act or speak with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who brood on this, hostility isn't stilled. He insulted me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. For those who don't brood on this, hostility is stilled. Hostilities aren't stilled through hostility, regardless. Hostilities are stilled through non-hostility. This is an unending truth. Unlike those who don't realize that we're here on the verge of perishing, those who do, their quarrels are stilled. So what he's getting at and what this whole sutta is really about is how we can skillfully approach dealing with things that are unpleasant, that are difficult, that make us unhappy in a variety of ways. I also wanted to read something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And this is, he's talking about the practice of mindfulness, and one of the things that the practice of mindfulness allows us to do. By emphasizing the recognition and knowing of the unwholesome roots and the wholesome roots in their absence, the Buddha is highlighting the wise discernment of what is skillful and what is unskillful. That is, discerning what leads to happiness and liberation and what leads to suffering. Although this discernment is basic to the Buddha's teachings, in our Western culture it is a very delicate process. For many people, it is an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to the feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. It's not a helpful cycle. It is important to understand which mind states are skillful and which are unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves or to be reactive to them, but in order to see which leads to happiness and should be cultivated in our lives, and which leads to suffering and should be abandoned. The distinction between wholesome and unwholesome mind states brings a moral dimension into psychology. This is particularly important because these different states are not only arising in our minds, they are also motivating our actions. So it's really important that I want to read this verse because it's really important. It's like, you know, we say, you hear the word taint and it's like, oh, it's something bad. Did I do something wrong that I'm tainted? You know, it's like, it's so easy to get caught up in that sort of thought process of self-blame. And it just is useless. Because, oh look, guess what? I'm a human being, and sometimes I'm not that skillful. Sometimes I do stupid things. It's just the nature of being a human being, right? And we also have habits. Sometimes not so wholesome habits. And that's also just being a human being. And so all we're trying to do is look at these things and see, number one, if I'm mindful and see that I'm caught in one of these mind states, and this is one of the main points the Buddha makes about mindfulness, especially at the beginning of the practice, but even later on, is that it helps us discriminate. We're mindful of something arising in the mind, we should do this or say that and blah, blah, blah. And then we go, oh, I know where that goes. This is not a wholesome thing. This is not a wholesome idea. It's going to cause harm for myself and for others. Maybe I don't need to do that. Mindfulness allows us to see these things clearly and then work with them skillfully. And this whole sutta is all about that. But I want to quote one other thing. In the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, the very first thing he says, almost, in the whole sutta is, Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. Purification is another one of those words that can set people squirming, right? But what he means is, we can start to see these unwholesome patterns, these unskillful things, these taints, and then work skillfully to overcome them and to gradually remove them from our patterns of thought and practice. That's what he's talking about here. So it's not like, once again, oh, I should be pure all the time. It's just that we're gradually, and what the process of practice allows us to do is gradually over time, a long time perhaps, gradually purify ourselves more and more. Little bit, little bit, little bit. So I want to read something from the sutta. Because then here's the good news. In this sutta, the Buddha then lays out seven different ways. We can work skillfully with these things when they arise. So it's not like, well, just get rid of them. What's wrong with you? You know, he has quite a wide variety of suggestions here, and that's what I really wanted to share. And here's what he has to say. Bhikkhus, there are taints that should be abandoned by seeing. There are taints that should be abandoned by restraining. There are taints that should be abandoned by using. There are taints that should be abandoned by enduring. There are taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. There are taints that should be abandoned by removing. There are taints that should be abandoned by developing. Quite a list, huh? And so basically what I want to do is talk about what he means. What are these seven things, and how does that fit in? And the first of these is seeing. And that's and what he's getting at here is what mindfulness allows us to do. It allows us to see them. And just seeing these things and going, oh, I know where that is. I know where this is going. Maybe all we need to do, just being able to actually see them for what they are, and then, because then once we see them, then we can make skillful choices. This way or that way, more wholesome, less wholesome, more happiness, more joy, less happiness, less joy, more purity, less purity. These are, and we can set our intention to always lean on the side of more wholesome, more pure, more happiness, more joy. It's an intentional practice. Remember, right intention, the second step on the Eightfold Path. This is where right intention starts to really have meaning, when we start to look at these sorts of things and go, oh, okay, I can see that that intention isn't so skillful. Anyhow, I want to read a little bit more from the sutta here. This is how he attends wisely. This is how he attends unwisely. So he's talking about how we sometimes think in ways that are unwise, unfruitful. This is how he attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? When he attends unwisely in this way, one of six views arises in him. The view self exists for me arises in him as true and established. Or the view no self exists for me arises in him. Or the view I perceive self with self arise in him as true and established. Or the view I perceive not self with self. Or the view I perceive self and not self arise in him as true and established. And both things are true. And then neither things are true. And he goes on and on. And he goes, but this self of mine is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. This speculative view, because it was called the thicket of views, the wilderness of views, the contortion of views, the vacillation of views, the fetter of views. Fettered by the fetter of views, the untaught ordinary person, that's us, is not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, despair. He is not freed from suffering, I say. So what's he getting at here? He's getting at the idea that we can spend an enormous amount of time in these sort of philosophical meanderings about what's happened, what that happened in the past, what will happen in the future. Did I have past lives? Will I have future lives? Blah, blah, blah. Or you know, all these different views on what a self is. Now, which one of those is true? And all of this is just basically an enormous waste of time. Because it isn't productive of anything. Because we can't figure out these things. That's our mind goes, I'm really smart. I can figure these things out. But you can't. They're not figurable. They're a waste of time. And the Buddha says similar things in several other places in the sutta, where, you know, being caught up in this sort of speculative fiction, that's what it is, just is not useful. It's unwholesome to spend time figuring this out. And then he says, but there are some things that are useful to think about. He attends wisely. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him: personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observance. These are called the taints that can be abandoned by seeing. So he's saying, just let the Four Noble Truths be what you contemplate. And let the Four Noble Truths be what you get to know by experience. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddhist instructions on mindfulness, the last instruction could pretty much exactly these words. The last instruction in mindfulness is to know these, not in some intellectual understanding way, but in some deep internal experiential way. Know that these are true. Because here what they remove, and he has his list, he says, the view of a separate personality, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. This is something that we start clinging. We cling to the idea that there are certain ways that things should always be. You know, we should do it this way and that way. This was a big topic for the Buddha, because he was living in a Brahmanic culture where the Brahmins, the priestly caste, had a way of doing everything. And if you weren't of the Brahmic caste, all you could do was pay a Brahmin to do these rituals for you, to take care of, you know, get rain, not get rain, too much rain, want a baby boy, don't want a baby boy, etc., etc., etc. It went on and on and on. There would be rituals literally for everything. And he was saying, no, don't get caught there. Just understand truly that the Four Noble Truths are the thing you need to understand. So that's the first of the seven ways. Then there's this one's restraining. And this is, the note I have here, I'll read the sutta. Here a bhikkhu wisely abides with the eye faculty restraints, while taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the eye faculty unrestrained. There are no taints, vexations, or fevers in one who abides with the eye faculty restraints. And he goes on and lists the other senses. So here he's talking about how we through our senses and through trying to satisfy our senses just get ourselves into more and more trouble. And it's not that sensual things are bad, once again. It's like there are, you know, you can be hiking in the mountains and sit on a rock and see this beautiful view of the mountains, and it can be just absolutely glorious and joyful. So it's not like seeing things or tasting wonderful things or anything, but it's when they become what we seek out and have to have. And if we can restrain, step back a little and go, I don't really need that piece of chocolate cake right now. It would be nice, but I don't need it right now. I don't need it for nutrition or anything. And so I'll just not have that piece of chocolate cake. I'm speaking from personal chocolate cake addiction myself. So, and so it's an interesting view. And once again, the idea of restraint is commonly thought of as, ooh, who wants to restrain? How boring, how not fun, right? Let me share something else here. This is from Seeking the Heart of Wisdom by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. When we deeply understand that actions bring results, it can motivate us to take active responsibility for our actions and our lives. We develop a wise reflection and consider about where our actions are leading and whether that is where we want to go. This is that what mindfulness allows us to do. I was mentioning this just earlier. But it's not enough to simply reflect on the direction of our lives. We must have some force or quality in the mind that can directly apply the wisdom of our reflections. One of the great powers and strengths of mind that we can use for this purpose is the power of restraint. It is important to understand that restraint means because it lies at the heart of our practice. We should be careful not to confuse restraint with repression or avoidance. Restraint of mind does not mean pushing something away or denying its presence. It does not mean being judgmental or having an aversion towards certain aspects of our experience. When we suppress or avoid certain aspects of ourselves, the ignorance of not acknowledging what is present creates more tension and pain in the mind. With restraint, we are open to everything that arises, but we see with discriminating wisdom, without becoming lost or forgetful. With wisdom and awareness, we can see that these are skillful activities that are conducive to greater happiness and understanding, and there are unskillful ones that lead to further suffering and conflict. Restraint is the capacity we have to discriminate one from the other. And the strength and composure of mind to pursue the skillful courses. I like this definition of restraint. Restraint is the capacity we have to discriminate one from the other, from the skillful and the unskillful, and the strength and composure of mind to pursue the skillful course. It makes it sound so simple, doesn't it? Then it's using. And using is an interesting thing, because in the sutta, the Buddha talks about the monastics using what's called the four requisites. You know, they have robes, alms food, shelter, and medicine. And it's skillful to use these because you need them to take care of the body. And this is something also that we have to be aware of. That it is, like, it's really important that we have this physical vehicle. And it's this physical vehicle that allows us to practice. And we need to take care of it. And we need to take care of it as best we can. I mean, so, you know, bodies wear out, bodies age, things happen, you know, we get sick, who knows? But as much as we can, we have to actually consciously use what we get. Like, we use food to keep the body healthy, not just to, you know, for enjoyment. Use, you know, clothing. Use our shelter and the space we live in. It's like all these things are important. We have to take care of these things. We're householders. We need, you know, we're not like monastics or someone else would take care of these for us. That's what the duty of householders were, to take care of the monastics. So we have to take care of these things, but try not to use them more than we need. I mean, here's an example from the sutta. With what taints bhikkhus can be abandoned by using? Here, bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing private parts. In other words, use it for what it's meant to do, to take care of things in the world, and that's it. And so this is implying that often taints try and get us, like, oh, I need another one of those. I want more of that. I want more of this. I should have one of those because someone else has one of these. Blah, 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 blah. And using says, no, I can use these things, but only to the extent I need them to, you know, take care of myself. Or so that I can be safe, happy, healthy, and at ease without overdoing it. And this doesn't mean that you need to sort of be poor and you know, we're not monastics, right? We're householders. This is a section from What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Rahula. It's quite an interesting little book. And this is he's talking about householders here. Once the Buddha told Anathapindika, the great banker, one of his most avoided lay disciples, who leads an ordinary family life, has four kinds of happiness. The first happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. So it's okay to make money. It's okay to have wealth even. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends, and relatives, and on meritorious deeds, in other words, taking care of others. So you have wealth and you share it with people who have less. The third is to be free from debts. Which is an interesting list. And the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life without committing evil in thought, word, or deed, and thus leading an ethical life. I think the interesting one here in our culture is free from debt, because that's so against what our culture says. Our culture also says make all the money you can and those other people can take care of themselves. And it's really important that we understand that if we're lucky enough to have things going okay, we need to share it with others who where it's not going okay in whatever way it seems appropriate. But he's pointing right here to, it's okay to have stuff, it's okay to use stuff, it's just don't overdo it. Don't go into debt to get that next wonderful thing. In our culture, it's pretty impossible to do that if you want to own a house, and I understand that, having had a mortgage once upon a time in my life. But when I did have a mortgage, I worked really hard and paid it off. You know, there was like balloon payments and all this. So I could choose, oh, am I going to go on this vacation or buy this new car, even though my old car is getting kind of funky, it's still working, or can I take that money and make the next balloon payment against my mortgage to get out of debt? And this is actually skillful thinking. You think about these things and go, oh, maybe I don't really need to go on that exotic vacation. I can use that same money to put that money against my mortgage and pay my mortgage off in more than, well, I had a 20-year mortgage that I paid off in 11 years, but I mean, now everybody has 30-year mortgages, right? But it's like, just to choose those, that sort of thing, because being in debt automatically means you have to then work to pay off the debt. So now a lot of the energy you're putting out in the world is just so that you can take care of that debt. And it means you have less time to do other things that are... And it also means sometimes when you're doing things that maybe you're not that happy about or just a little weird, but do I need this job because I got this debt and I got to pay off my debt? And you can get caught in that space. I've been there too. I actually quit a job once. I had a really great job, I thought, till I found out the software I was writing was being used to detect nuclear submarines hidden in waters around Australia. I quickly left that job. But it's like, oh, you have to see these things. Anyhow, enduring. This is an interesting one. And enduring, what taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by enduring? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing. While taints, affectation, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no taints, affectation, or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. Another thing that doesn't sound that pleasant. Enduring is like, oh God, I have to endure it. It's like it's a big problem, right? But really, enduring means there's things that arise that we can't do anything about. We just have to endure them. I can't fix that. I can't change that. I have to just endure it. And enduring means not putting a lot of energy into trying to avoid the unavoidable. not putting a lot of energy in that place, because it's just all that energy you're putting there to avoid the unavoidable could be put into practice, could be put into service, could be put into very useful things. And it's once again, it's a choice we keep making. And somehow we also, this has to do with practice as well, I think, because we get this idea that we need sort of perfect conditions to practice. Right? And there you are, maybe where you're living, you know, there's a lot of people, especially in the summer, people are outside with barking dogs. That's one of my neighborhood. We've got a couple of real barkers in my neighborhood. And I'm practicing and I'm sitting, and all of a sudden there's one of those dogs barking. And instead of getting all wound up about it, I can just go, oh, barking dog. Just note it. I can't avoid the fact that that dog is barking. There's no way I can avoid this. So why get wound up about it? You know, just note it. It's just like, oh, that's what's there now. And note the annoyance. Note how unpleasant it is. But that's life. This is what life is like. This that stuff happens. You know. Share another little tidbit from Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. And he's talking about, and they're talking about the power of meditation to help us endure. One of the great qualities of meditative practice. As we let the body and breath settle down, the next aspect of arriving is settling the mind. What do we see when we look at the mind? Constant change. In the traditional scriptures, the untrained and unconcentrated mind is referred to as a mad monkey. As we look for ourselves, we see that it's like a circus or a zoo in there. The parrot, the sloth, the mouse, the tiger, the bear, and the silent owl are all represented. It's like a flywheel of spinning thoughts, emotions, images, stories, likes, dislikes, and so forth. There is ceaseless movement filled with plans, ideas, and memories. Seeing this previously unconscious stream of inner dialogue is for many people the first insight in practice. It's called seeing the waterfall. I like this image. Already we begin to learn what the nature of mind. Its constant change is like the weather. Today it rains, tonight it may snow, earlier the sun was out. Sounds like Boulder weather every day. Sometimes it's muddy in the spring, and then the summer comes and the wind comes. In the fall the leaves go, in the winter the ice forms. We're like that. We're part of nature. Our meditation isn't fulfilled by achieving some special state. It's beginning to find a genuine relationship to this organic body of heart and mind that we are. We can then discover our spiritual practice in every season. So we practice and see the waterfall, and we see all the parts of ourselves. For the mind to become settled in the present moment, in the midst of so much change, that's what we're trying to do. In the midst of the unavoidable, in the midst of all that stuff that if we're not careful, we just get wound about and let them annoy us, we just go, that's okay. That's what's there now. That dog is barking. I can't stop the dog. I can't, you know, make the neighbors, you know, take their dog in. The dog's out there barking. It's being a dog. It's what dogs do. They bark. Right? There's the other side of this, however, this business of enduring that I want to make sure is also clear. We can turn this into some sort of, like, fierce warrior thing, like, I'm going to endure this no matter what. You know, this is especially true of people who get who sit for long periods and get pain, body pains in their joints. I can't tell you the number of people I know who are longtime experienced practitioners who've had knee and hip replacements because they endured when they shouldn't be enduring. When they should have stepped back and go, oh, maybe right now, instead of sitting on the floor cross-legged for another hour, I'm going to sit in that chair. Or maybe I'm going to do some walking practice instead of just sitting again to sort of get my body moving and not get caught up in the pain and endure it because I'm this fierce meditator. That's an example I have seen a lot of in my, not in my own personal life, because I started sitting in chairs fairly early on. I was never very good sitting cross-legged. Too old, too stiff. Even when I was young, I was too stiff. But it's like there's this whole, I guess, macho might be the word, though it could apply whatever the female form of macho is. I'm sure there is one. There's this whole thing of like, I'm gonna tough it out. I have to tough it out. That's what the teaching says. I should sit this way, and I should sit this way no matter what. And if you're causing pain, think about pain as pain can be quite useful as in short doses as a way to concentrate the mind and to sort of point things out to you. But long-term pain is just like, oh, I'm damaging my body. And that's why all these people I know had hip and knee replacements, because they literally damaged their bodies practicing, because they were going to endure. So we gotta, this is one of those ones that if there's a little balance we have to find on this one. Then we come to number five, which is avoiding. And this is actually the first part of wise effort, you know, avoiding the causes of unwholesome mind states. You know, there are things we know are unwise. Don't go there. Just don't go there. I mean, we see something going, you know, this idea, oh, I should go do X. And then wisely I go, oh, every time I go do X, I end up getting caught in unwholesome activity of some sort. I used to binge drink back in college days. I never it took me a long time to figure out that it's just like really stupid. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Okay. This is interesting. He says, this is from the sutta. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts, and associating with bad friends. Since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no taints, vexations, and fever for one who avoids them. This is one of the difficulties of practice. As you start to calm down and you start to see things more clearly, and you start to go, oh, I really don't need to do that, because I know where it goes. But that's something you used to do with a friend or a bunch of friends. And they say, hey, let's go do X. And you're going, no, I don't think that's a good idea. It sort of gets in the way of old friendships sometimes, old companionships sometimes. This practice changes your life. And part of changing your life is changing who you associate with. That's the importance of Sangha, is that now you can associate with Sangha, with people of like mind. This is difficult. Especially, not so much friends, but around family. You know, families get together and they fall into those old patterns of how what families do together. And sometimes it's just not very wholesome, not very useful anymore. And it's very difficult to let that go And also, sometimes you just have to endure with families. You know, you're at the family get together, and that crazy uncle is there, ranting yet again about what he usually rants about. And you can't sort of, you know, just get up and walk away because this is family. Right? So now this is where instead of avoiding, enduring comes up. You know, so these strategies are flexible and depending on the situation. And then we have removing. And this is actually the second part of right effort. You know, when unwholesome mind states arise, because we're human beings struggling along the path, then we see them and we go, oh, this has arisen. I'm in the midst of a storm of nonsense. And I have to do something to consciously steer and let go of that, whatever it is I'm caught in. Let it be, let it dissipate. Not always easy. There is a whole sutta about this called the removal of distracting thoughts, where the Buddha actually lists 5 ways to work with things that once they've arisen, once you see, oh, here I'm in the midst of this now. It isn't something I have avoided because I'm here. I am. I didn't avoid it. Now here I am in the midst. How can I skillfully work with this? The one I found most useful to me is because almost in all cases those mental storms I'm talking about have someone else involved. It's just a two-person story. So sometimes it's just me beating myself up, but usually it's a two-person story. And either I'm the bum and they're the hero, or vice versa. And if I can just see that, see, I'm just caught in yet another one of these unwholesome, ranty stories. Can I step back far enough so that I can, instead of ranting about this person, whether it's myself or the other, offer metta to this person? This is the way to remove unwholesome mental formation, simply by replacing it with something wholesome. Consciously choosing to steer your mind in a different direction than it's caught. This seems contradictory to how mindfulness is almost often taught, by the way, where mindfulness is often taught as like, oh no, just whatever's there and you got to pay attention to it. And that's true. But I heard Joseph Goldstein say one time, if you've paid attention to something, and it's, there it is again and again, just recurring, and you've really honestly paid attention to it and looked at it and felt it in the body, and you've done that 5 times, then when time number six arises, just say, nope, not going to go there. And we do something like this, and there are more forceful things you can do as well. But it's like, sometimes it isn't skillful. And this is where the skill and practice comes in. You know, we have to see whether it's skillful to let that go, to not go there anymore, to, I've been through this, I've felt it, I know this, but there it is, the same old story yet again, and I can just go, no, sorry, not anymore, thank you very much. This is a choice we have to make. Then, so that's number 6. Number 7, developing. And this is what the Buddha talks about here in the sutta, is developing the 7 factors of awakening. Can we not only avoid what is unwholesome, but develop what leads to more wholesomeness? You know, mindfulness being the primary one. Mindfulness is the beginning of the 7 factors of awakening. And we have to remember that what we call mindfulness practice doesn't automatically mean when we're doing mindfulness practice that we're being mindful. Interesting, huh? It means that we're doing whatever we can to create the causes and conditions such that the mental formation of mindfulness will actually arise. So that mindfulness, clear mind, a mind that is clear and precise and can see things as they arise and not get caught by them. Ah, now mindfulness has arisen. All that practice, the methodology, the skillful means that we've been using now have borne fruit in a sense, and mindfulness has actually arisen. Then from that place we can start going through the other factors, investigation of dhammas, which is like starting to see what's going on underneath the top layer, what's arising in the mind, and starting to see very clearly how everything that's arising is impermanent, because everything arises, is there for a while, and then it's gone. And we can actually do that. And if we're mindful, if the mind is clear and precise, we can start actually seeing below the surface of that, whatever the stuff is that's arising, and just say, oh, that's just another impermanent arising, because it's gone now. That's the nature of all things. And then, you know, putting in more energy, putting what we'll call excited interest, the sort of like something arises and it's like, wow. We get the wow moments of practice where we just, things are just so clear and so precise and so joyful. And understanding that that's part of what happens. And we can encourage that and move that along. And then we get kind of tranquility. The mind goes really still. The body goes really still. Concentration and equanimity. These are all factors of awakening. So this is a sequential process. And all of these are extremely wholesome mental formations. And we can start to cultivate them. This is a way of you know, restraining and avoiding the taints, is to just not go there at all. Instead, you know, do what we can to, you know, bring these other more wholesome mind states around, and be happy with that. To consciously choose to move in that direction. This is something that happens as we get deeper into the practice, where these seven factors become things that we actually can see and notice and work skillfully, encourage and work with. There's another little piece here, though. So this is the sutta, the seven factors, you know, the Buddha's been talking about. Here's something. Something I find quite interesting, and that's, this is once again from Joseph Goldstein's book. It's interesting to reflect on what impurities, what we call taints here, means in terms of our practice. Some aspects of the word are obvious, like wrong actions of body and speech, and unwholesome thoughts like greed, ill will, and cruelty. But the Buddha also spoke of subtle impurities, such as being lost in worldly thoughts of family, friends, of reputation, of work. You ever find that happens while you're sitting there doing your daily meditation, that the mind just goes off into, like the number of paintings I've painted in my sitting meditations, if I'd actually painted them all, I'd have to own a whole warehouse for them all. As lay people living in the world, we do not need to think about these things. We do need to think about these things sometimes. So sometimes we have to think about this stuff, because we live in the world and we have to deal with these things, right? But very often we're simply lost in a kind of unnoticed reverie about them, drifting along in habits of thought that may or may not be particularly unwholesome, but may be inappropriate or unnecessary for the task at hand. Are they necessary? Probably not. And an even subtler level of impurity is when we're lost in Dharma thoughts about our practice and different meditative states. These thoughts are so seductive precisely because they are about the Dhamma. And as with worldly thoughts, there are times when conscious, mindful Dharma reflection can be a big help on the path. But when we're simply lost in Dharma reveries or in judgments about our practice, they are not particularly helpful. That last one is really the key to this, I think. Judgments of our practice. It's so easy to get caught up in, oh, my practice isn't going well today. Wait, I just went and I sat for half an hour like I always do. I was still and I sat. Yes, it wasn't like this glorious time 2 weeks ago when I was like perfectly still and calm and mindfulness was there. And I was sort of struggling and my mind was wandering. So we judge ourselves that I wasn't perfect. You were disciplined enough to go sit for half an hour. This is a huge thing to do. Huge thing to do. So judging our practice, and this also leads to comparing, like, oh, you know, you read about this person who, and this is what happened in the practice, or some Dharma talk, some person mentions what was practiced, what happened in their practice, and you think somehow that's how your practice should be. You compare your practice to some other practice, someone else's description of their practice. That's them. Nothing to do with you. Really. Nothing to do with you at all. It's just that's what happened to them. And your practice might be totally different. Before I came to this form of practice, I spent 25 years doing mantra practice in a Hindu traditional school with an Indian teacher. And some of my friends who were, you know, part of the Sangha would say things to me like, you know, they'd describe some amazing thing that had happened to them while they were meditating. And they would say to me, so tell me what happens to you. And I'd say, I'd say something along the lines of, well, I sit there and I concentrate as best I can. Nothing phenomenal, nothing extraordinary. It wasn't floating or anything like that. And they would like, how can you keep practicing? And it's like, well, I had faith in the practice, and that's what I did. And they were always, it's like, how could you, and that's the nature of this of practice, of all meditative practice. It has sort of these long periods of sort of even, steady, almost minutely subtle changes. And then there's periods where all of a sudden something goes and something happens. And it puts you on a different plane, in a sense. It's just the nature of practice. So comparing ourselves to someone else or something that happened yesterday in our own practice, it's just not skillful. In fact, it's harmful. Because it just discourages us that we're not always in that beautiful place I got to once upon a time. We just need to sort of have a simpler view of things. This is from Ryokan, One Robe, One Bowl. It's a Zen poet of the 17th century. The rain has stopped. The clouds have drifted away. And the weather is clear again. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world are pure. Abandon this fleeting world. Abandon yourself. Then the moon and flowers will guide you along the way. Pointing to the simplicity of practice. It's a very Zen view, but I like it just because it's so simple. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world are pure. And then, I think it's a two-poem night. This is Dana Fald's Go In and In. called metamorphosis. Called beyond the confines of this chrysalis by a force I cannot see or name, I'm compelled by pain and something bigger than myself to leave the protection of all that I have known. There is struggle, doubt, and awkward setting forth. Finally, I break free of the cocoon and find myself surrounded by air and light. I dare to act, still not knowing what I am. Instinct, or maybe faith, bids me move forward, make the leap, explore this mystery of change and flight. I find myself with wings that dwarf my former world. Unfurled, they dry quickly in the sun. I, who had expected to spend my days crawling, now teach myself to soar. Such a rush of wind and freedom. That first flight teaches me more than I had learned in a lifetime of crawling. It's like the images here. So that's all I have to share tonight.